He would kill her and turn her body into another spectacle. And it was all my fault. I pressed my hands against my eyes until all I saw were white flashes behind my closed lids. I could not simply sit and wait for Liza to be returned, unharmed. It went against everything I held dear. But I also could not make it obvious that I was searching for her. I stood, pacing around the small cabin, never feeling more as if I had been a bird trapped in a metal cage. How a ship could contain so many nooks and crannies and darkened places to commit nefarious deeds was beyond comprehension. I rushed over to the service wall and rang for an attendant. I needed to send for the one person who could help in this situation. I scribbled a note with instructions on where to meet, and had already donned my overcoat and pulled on thick gloves by the time the maid arrived. "Take this straight away. Please let him know it's urgent." She nodded and left as swiftly as she'd arrived. Unable to wait any longer, I slipped into the night and ran toward the only place left where I felt free from the metal walls closing in. 36. Midnight Rendezvous. First Class Promenade, RMS Etruria, 8 January, 1889. I examined the vast expanse of ocean, watching as its nothingness grew into a monster so large I had no hope of ever evading it. My heart rate jumped into a full-on trot. It was hard to fathom that I'd thought this voyage would be fit for daydreams at the start of the week. Now Liza was taken, her finger sitting in a velvet box, and there was an entire ship full of mysterious people who each possessed opportunity and motive. Surely the answer had to be there, glinting like a shard of broken glass reflecting moonlight, waiting to be discovered. If only I could grasp it before something unthinkable happened to my cousin. I felt his presence before he spoke and faced him. In the dark, he was nothing more than a silhouette before he stepped closer. "Have you found anything out?" I stammered. Thomas wrapped his coat around my shoulders and gazed out at the sea.
"Captain Norwood has the entire crew searching the ship. They're combing every inch. Your uncle's wrath is more motivating than anything, I believe. If Liza..."
He drew in a sharp breath and exhaled loudly.
"They won't stop searching for her."
He held me close, though it didn't stop the internal shudders from racking my body. Liza was being tortured. I had done that to her. My wretched affinity for getting involved with crimes now placed her into the heart of one. Father had been correct all those months ago. Decent people didn't expose themselves to the underbelly of the world. I looked out at the undulating black waves, tucked beneath Thomas's arms. We stayed that way for a few moments, though the majority of me was buzzing with a need for action. I wanted to rush from room to room, screaming, until Liza was found. If I didn't gain control of my emotions and clear my mind, I'd be of no use to my cousin. They'd likely haul me off to the brig, and that would only complicate things. My heart contracted. I longed to shatter myself against the ship and sink to the ocean floor. Instead, I set my jaw. "I cannot shake the feeling of a connection we're missing. What do the cards have to do with everything?" Thomas glanced at me from the corner of his eye.
"At this point, I'm not sure it matters."
"Everything matters, and you know it," I sighed. "Jack the Ripper chose women who were forced to sell themselves. The Dracula case targeted mostly members of the House of Basarab. What of these women? There has to be some tie that binds them together in the murderer's mind. How do these puzzle pieces fit? Better yet, who knew them before they set foot on the Etruria? And why take Liza? What does she have to do with it?"
"Well, they seem to have known each other prior to boarding the ship. That is a fact between Dr. Arden and the Prescotts, at least. As for your cousin..."
Thomas inhaled deeply.
"She's likely only a bartering piece. We're gaining ground on the murderer, and he isn't pleased. A nerve has been struck, and he or she is lashing out."
I huddled into Thomas's overcoat as a particularly icy blast of air whipped along the promenade. "There's something about the cards that bothers me, and I can't quite figure out why."
He raised a brow, eyes sparkling. You've got an idea, don't you?
Come, I said, tugging him toward the cabins, finally able to put my energy into action. I know just who might have an answer for us.
Houdini opened his door and cast a weary glance at us. I was surprised to find him alone, no Gian or Andreas or even Mephistopheles. On a small table near his bed lay a book with drawings and diagrams, most of which appeared to be contraptions that would make death shudder.
Are you going to go through with the torture cell trick? I asked, moving fully into the rather large space as he swept his arm in welcome. Several trunks and tables were stacked around in messy piles, cards and cuffs and chains all spilling from them.
I ain't quitting this business. No matter how many bodies show up, I won't be intimidated by nothing.
He narrowed his eyes.
Did Liza send you here?
Hearing her name sent needles spiking through my system. He hadn't yet heard she was the newest victim. I couldn't bring myself to respond. Thomas moved forward.
No, Thomas's voice was cordial enough to be a warning. But Miss Wadsworth will gladly send you overboard if you keep that tone up.
At Houdini's confused expression, he added,
She's the muscle. I'm clearly the charm.
Houdini shook his head as if to free himself of the absurdity of the idea and moved over to the bed.
If Liza didn't send you, then why are you here?
I have questions about playing cards.
I interrupted Thomas before he could provide any more charm.
As the king of cards, I figured you'd be the perfect person to answer them.
He eyed me warily, but finally nodded.
What do you want to know?
I pulled out the cards found with or near the victims and laid them on the table, feeling only marginally terrible at having kept them. Normally, I'd never consider tampering with evidence. I hadn't a clue if the order in which they were found mattered. But I did my best to set them down in the time period they were first discovered.
Five of hearts, ace of clubs, ace of spades, six of diamonds,
he said, glancing up.
Where's the rest of the deck?
That's all there is, I said, pointing to the first card. Do they mean anything?
If he noticed the slight hesitation in my statement, he didn't let on. He picked up the cards, inspecting them carefully on each side.
For starters, these are Mephistopheles' personal set.
Thomas went very still beside me.
How can you be sure?
Houdini flicked something on the card with his pointer finger.
See that?
I leaned in for a better look at the thorns woven around the edges of each card.
And these?
Houdini showed us tiny cursive, making up the circular shapes on the back of the cards.
Vincere Velmori.
Conquer or die? I asked, silently thanking Headmaster Moldovino for forcing us to freshen up on our Latin.
If you say so.
Houdini lifted a shoulder.
What it means doesn't matter to me.
Why does this lead you to believe Mephistopheles is the owner of these cards?
He's got the thorns and Latin all over most of his things. Surely you noticed it all over the practice rooms.
Houdini grinned.
It was also etched onto the fountains the night you danced with the Green Fairy. You might not recall that, though, seeing as you'd partaken in spirits.
I felt Thomas's attention on me and realized he was slowly piecing the puzzle together of what that statement meant. Clearly, I had been keeping things from him, and he was not looking pleased. Knowing him, though, he was likely more annoyed that he'd not deduced it first.
What else can you tell us about these cards? I asked. Why might they be significant?
Houdini stared at them again, focus turning inward.
Six of diamonds is known for romantic problems, arguments, and basic lovers' quarrels, according to your cousin.
Liza told you that? I asked, frowning. I knew my cousin enjoyed the idea of seances and convening with spirits, but I hadn't known of her talent with reading cards. I could have been seeking her advice on cartomancy this entire time.
I told her it was a load of crap. She said, so's flirting with other girls, then stormed out.
He picked up the ace of spades, turning it one way, then the other.
This one means misfortune. Sometimes it's also a difficult ending.
He moved the ace of clubs and five of hearts around.
Not sure about these. If anyone can figure it out, Sebastian, Andreas, or even Anisha can probably help you, if Liza won't. But don't get your hopes up. This stuff don't really mean nothing. They're just cards.
Anisha is also talented with cartomancy? I asked. I thought she only knew tarot.
Houdini gave me a strange look.
She's the one who told Mephistopheles everyone needed to learn, that we could expand our business if we had more fortune tellers. Andreas was only doing that Bavarian magic looking glass bit before her, and to be honest, it wasn't all that good.
My thoughts whirled with new possibilities. If Anisha was that talented with both kinds of cards, then she might be the very person we were looking for. Perhaps her feelings for Mephistopheles weren't as I'd suspected. I suppose it was possible that he'd entered into some bargain with the families that had been targeted, and she didn't approve. Houdini raised his brows, probably wondering at the look of excitement I was sure was showing on my face. Thank you, I said. You've been very helpful. Thomas motioned for me to exit the room, then halted, fingers strumming along the doorframe while he studied Houdini.
Why were you initially arguing with Liza?
Houdini's gaze strayed to mine, and I hoped he didn't say to ask me about it. I would have a hard time explaining how I witnessed their fight at one of my secret practices. I was already dreading the green fairy explanation I knew was coming. The moment passed, and he lifted a shoulder.
A dead woman's floating in my tank, and all she wants to ask about is who the lady I'm writing to in America is.
Houdini exhaled dramatically.
I told her it was nothing. I ain't got no sweetheart nowhere. Only woman I love, or write to, in America, is my mother. Liza didn't believe it.
Thomas was silent for a moment, focus drifting over the room. Lord only knew what he'd divined from it and the young escape artist.
No, I suppose she didn't. Good night.
It took everything in me to keep from asking a dozen questions as we made our way through the empty corridors and climbed the stairs. When we'd reached the second floor, I stopped. We were secreted away in a stairwell. Hopefully no one would overhear us. Well, I asked, do you believe him?
Yes. Whether or not I believe every word out of his mouth is another matter entirely.
Thomas inhaled deeply.
I know you don't want to see the truth behind Mephistopheles' illusion, Wadsworth. But as of this moment, he's dangerous. He's secretive, and his playing cards were left with almost every victim.
Which seems awfully convenient as far as evidence piling up, I argued. You must admit, it sounds as if someone's going out of their way to make him the obvious suspect. And what of Anisha? She's someone who we've not fully looked into, but clearly is a valid option.
Undoubtedly,
Thomas said, lowering his voice. He looked down, fiddling with a button on his sleeve, and my stomach clenched.
We need to talk.
I couldn't deny that I figured a serious conversation was coming, though part of me longed to run off and hide. There were some things I'd rather not face. All right. Thomas folded his arms against his chest and watched me very closely.
You've been meeting with Mephistopheles at night.
It wasn't really a question, though he had the courtesy to frame it as such. I swallowed hard and nodded. I was a coward.
You drank absinthe and danced with him?
I closed my eyes and drew in a deep breath. Yes. When Thomas didn't answer straight away, I finally managed to sneak a peek at him. I expected to see anger and betrayal written across his expression. What I actually found was much worse. Before his face shuttered, I saw a glimpse of the boy who never truly believed he could be loved. The one I had promised to never hurt. A promise I'd just broken, along with his tender heart. His eyes were void of emotion when he met my stare.
I meant what I said about you being free,
he said, voice barely above a whisper. If there's a chance, you might be. If you think you're hot.
He blinked quickly enough that any hint of wetness was gone before I could be certain. He cleared his throat.
I won't ever tell you who to choose or which path to take. But I would ask that you tell me one thing. Do you have feelings for him?
My heart thudded against my ribs. I wanted to cry out that that was an absurd question. But for some reason, the words failed to rally past my lips. Thomas could spot a lie as easily as one could spot the sun on the horizon. And I had no intention of lying to him. The truth was complicated and messy, but he deserved to know every doubt lurking inside me. I held my hands out, palms up. I'm not certain what I feel. He scrubbed his hands over his face. I reached out, hating myself for the conflict bashing about within me. I clasped his hands and drew them away, searching for some way to comfort him, to quell his fears. But anything I said now would ring false. The truth I hadn't been wanting to face was simple. Somehow, I wouldn't remotely call it love. It had been far too soon for that. But somehow, I'd realized that my heart might be capable of finding interest in another. I could deny it, try pretending it away. But I was starting to care for Mephistopheles. It was like a small, fragile bud. Given enough care and attention, it might bloom into something beautiful. I didn't know what that meant for Thomas and myself. He deserved to have someone love him wholly and without doubt. Neither of us had ever formally courted anyone. What did we know of ourselves or relationships, let alone marriage? I could not in good conscience relieve him of his doubts when mine could not be reasoned away. This might simply be a momentary lapse in judgment, a reaction based on fear, or it might be an indication I wasn't quite ready for that sort of commitment. At least, not until I could slay my doubts. Thomas,
Please, don't. He held a hand up. I never really...
He shook his head.
For all of my bravado and ability to read a situation, I never could calculate what you saw in me.
Thomas, you mustn't... I do love you, I just...
If you wish to go, I'll never make you stay. I might not do and say the proper thing all the time, but I do know that I love you enough to set you free.
I was about to argue that I didn't want to be free, but that wasn't true. All of my life I'd longed for freedom, freedom to pick and choose every detail of my life, to make good decisions and horrible ones, decisions that would break my heart and remake it 10 times over. I just never knew having choices could be so hard or hurt so much. A tear slipped down my face.
I love you, Wadsworth. No matter what or who you choose, I always will.
He leaned in and pressed his lips to my cheek.
If you'll excuse me, I must try and sort out the playing cards.
With that, he turned and hurried down the corridor. The blast of cold wind that blew in when he pushed the door open finally snapped me from my daze. Whatever strength I'd had vanished, and my knees gave out. I put my head in my hands and sobbed, not bothering to hide the sounds of my despair. My life was a tattered mess. Liza was in mortal danger. Thomas was heartbroken. A murderer made our ship his deadly playground. And I was filled with more turbulence than the ocean we traveled through. I permitted myself another moment to cry, allowing the tears to freely slip down my face, dripping onto the floor. It felt as if something in my chest had permanently cracked. I gripped my fists until the pain was all I could focus on. Then I pushed myself up, brushed down my bodice, and took a deep, shuddering breath. Liza was missing. A murderer was taunting me. No matter how much it pained me to think it, I could not focus on Thomas and our relationship now. Not wanting to waste another moment, stunted by my emotions, I exited onto the first-class deck and almost ran down the darkened promenade on the starboard side of the grand ship.
Wind howled, the sound reminding me of a man who'd lost the world in a game of cards. I clutched at my hat, keeping my face turned down against the breeze. Winter was reminding us that there were more fearsome things to worry over than simply men with agendas or girls with broken hearts on this boat. I gave up on walking swiftly and ran as fast as I could, my mind focused on the pattering drum of my feet, the beat of my pulse, the fear clawing its way down my spine. I needed to hurry, to scour the ship until I found my cousin. Movement toward the bow caught my attention, and I paused outside my cabin door, listening for any signs of struggle. Visions of bodies being tossed into the hungry ocean crawled their way into my sensibilities. I stared into the shadows, waiting for the darkness to lazily blink back at me, bringing all my fears to life. Sounds of sails snapping in the wind drew my attention upward, and I staggered back. Someone was standing up on the icy railing, his tailcoat a whip snapping behind him. All it would take was one slip, and he'd be plunged into the deadly waters. Moonlight broke through the cloud cover, offering a glimpse at the young man. He stared over the edge into the ocean, and before I knew what I was doing, I ran for him. Whether it was to save him or make him pay for his crime of confusing my heart, I couldn't tell. I simply raced until my arms were around him and we both crashed to the deck, the air whooshing out as I wrestled him to the ground. 37. Unmasked. First Class Promenade, RMS Etruria, 8 January, 1889. Mephistopheles rolled away from me, clutching his stomach and moaning.
I think you've broken one of my ribs. Was that really necessary? Next time you tackle me, be sure it's in one of our bedchambers.
I jumped to my feet, dragging the ringmaster with me. I clutched the collar of his shirt until he sputtered, hands fumbling to remove my fingers. I didn't care if I strangled him.
Are you quite mad? You almost fell overboard.
No.
He dropped to his knees, wheezing, but kept his focus on the deck, refusing to meet my glare.
I'm quite sane, and I was only checking on something.
Care to enlighten me?
No, not particularly.
He squinted as he stood.
Have you been crying?
I stepped back.
Liza has been.
My voice cracked, and I nearly lost my hold over myself once again.
Liza has been drinking, knitting children's socks, strangling Houdini with his chains, or better yet, his cuffs.
He rubbed my arms, voice softening.
Tell me, Liza's been...
I swiped at the tears that had managed to slip out.
Taken.
What do you mean, taken? Has Houdini done something to her?
He glared down the promenade and squared his shoulders, as if he'd go marching into battle this second. I shuddered, though I was no longer sure if it was due to the frosty air. Houdini was talented with cards himself. He might very well have taken my cousin and tortured her because of their fight. Perhaps he was acting back in his cabin. I trusted no one on this cursed vessel.
Someone sent her finger to my chambers.
Mephistopheles stared at me a moment, then unleashed a horde of curse words that weren't all in English. If I didn't feel so ill, I would have been impressed. He pressed his hands over his eyes and then dropped them to his sides.
All right. Start from the beginning. How do you know it's Liza's finger?
How is this helping?
I tossed my hands up.
Whether or not it's actually her finger is not the issue. The issue is someone who has murdered several people aboard this ship has taken her.
The ringmaster reached over and wrapped me in his arms. I was so surprised, I didn't protest.
There's more, isn't there? Why else were you crying?
I laid my head against his chest, listening to the quick thrum of his heart before pushing back.
I don't even know who you truly are, and yet you'd like to have my innermost thoughts laid bare.
Very well. You want the truth of me?
He sighed, reached up, and, quick enough for him to not change his mind, took his mask off. I stood there, mouth practically agape, and held in my gasp. After all this time, and his insistence that he remain anonymous, he'd just thrown it all away. His dark eyes were lined in darker lashes, his brows generous and bold, like him. A flop of black hair curled over his forehead and around his ears. I searched his face, seeking any flash of recognition. I would have sworn we'd known each other from some other life. But he was just a young man, ordinary and charming, with a dimple in his cheek. Was this truly who he was, or was it another mask to use to his advantage? His earlier words of not having the luxury of trusting anyone came back, haunting me like specters.
You've been murdering these girls, haven't you?
Not quite the reaction I was hoping for, Miss Wadsworth.
Mephistopheles jerked back and shook his head.
I suppose that's what keeps things interesting.
He ran a hand through his dark hair, tousling the already unruly locks.
But no, if it's a confession you're after, I'm afraid you won't find it here. I've not killed anyone or anything, except a few mosquitoes, and I don't feel too apologetic about that, especially after they took off with a hefty amount of blood and left wicked itching.
Honestly, I paused, noting how close we'd gotten again, my attention straying to his upturned lips, the longing in his eyes catching me completely off guard. He leaned in and gently pressed his mouth to mine, his touch shocking, but not unpleasant. For a moment I didn't think about every cursed thing that had happened in the last hour, focusing instead on his lips as they slowly parted. He clutched me close, hands gripping the material of my dress, as if convincing himself I was no illusion. I thought about running my hand through his curls. They were so lovely, yet a flash of Thomas's face snapped me into my senses. I broke away.
You swore you'd not kiss me!
You're partially correct,
he said, breathing hard and holding his palms out in surrender.
I said if you appeared as if you never wanted me to. But sometimes the way you gaze at me. I shouldn't have done it, Miss Wadsworth. I've told you from the start I'm not honorable or good.
Liar, fiend, second son, thief.
I stared down at my slippers.
Who are you really, Mephistopheles?
He opened his mouth and I silenced him with a raised hand.
No games. Tell me who you are and why I ought to believe anything more you say.
He inched forward, hands still up where I could see them, and sighed.
My name is Aidan Samir Baxter Thorne. My father is an earl, and my mother is an angel from Constantinople, as is evident by my exquisitely good looks.
When I didn't return his smile, he lowered his hands.
As you just kindly noted, I am the second son, the spare heir. I could either stay in England and spend money frivolously, or I could give it all up and pursue my dreams, debaucherous and lowly though they may be. I needn't get into which I chose. I put my engineering skills to use, and my flair for theatrics, and thus the Moonlight Carnival was born. A safe haven or sanctuary for other unwanteds, ones who've had it much worse than I have.
Something about his name kept dragging my attention back to it. Then I recalled the cards in Houdini's room.
Vincere vel mori.
Conquer or die. Our family motto for generations. My great-great-great, I'm not sure how many times over, but one of many greats grandfather, was granted knighthood by King Richard the Lionhearted. That's where the crest and motto come from, though I don't think we conquer much other than hearts and card games these days.
Mephistopheles's eyes grew reminiscent before he collected himself.
It seems you've been much better at your sleuthing than I've given you credit for.
Chills erupted like the undead from their graves and raced along my spine. I pulled out the card I'd taken from Houdini, watching the ringmaster's expression carefully.
Your calling cards, I believe. Very crass, but certainly a showy way of leaving a signature mark at the crime scenes.
Mephistopheles looked more confused than guilty.
Those cards, my love, might have been left at the crime scenes, but it wasn't done by me. They were stolen around the time my signet went missing.
He raised his brows.
Speaking of priceless family heirlooms, where is my signet now? Still with Cresswell?
It's in a safe place until I sort out all the truth from lies.
I flipped the card over, ignoring the twinge of guilt.
Is there anything special about these cards? Anything at all that might contain a hidden clue or meaning? No matter how obscure, anything might help.
Let's see. He took the card.
You see these?
I nodded. The little flourishes were lovely, but judging from the annoying slant of the ringmaster's lips, they held meaning.
This is an infinity symbol.
What does a double infinity mean?
Oh, some romantic nonsense about two fates being forever tied together.
He shrugged, then took in my expression, the levity leaving his voice.
What's wrong?
I believe that might mean something to the murderer. How do they all fit? I took the card back from him, turning it over and over, while fragmented thoughts slowly pieced themselves together. Nobility, a doctor, a justice of the peace. What is the common link? Two fates forever combined. Each playing card has an infinity symbol, and each tarot a deeper meaning of the same. I paced near the railing, ignoring the clapping of waves against the hull. Ace of spades. The ace of spades and the reversed seven of swords. What ties them together? Two fates, two stories, coming together as one.
Perhaps you need to sit for a moment, Mephistopheles said, no longer sounding like the tease he was. All this talk of romance has taken its toll.
He held a hand to his forehead, expression serious.
I feel the same.
In cartomancy, what does the Ace of Spades mean?
Mephistopheles searched my eyes, likely believing me to be as mad as the murderer. He rubbed his temple.
From what I can recall off the top of my head, it means misfortune or a difficult ending. Are you sure you're feeling quite well?
Exactly what Houdini had said. I waved him off, knowing I was onto something, and yet it was still slightly out of reach.
Lady Crenshaw was the catalyst. She set this whole thing into motion. I tapped the card.
Six of diamonds. Houdini said this card indicates arguments. Lord and Lady Crenshaw fought about something. An attractive girl. The cards that have been left are telling us exactly what sin the victim committed. The tarots are their fates, the ones they brought upon themselves.
Mephistopheles scrubbed a hand across his face.
This is a bit far-fetched, and if I'm saying that, you can be certain it's a stretch. If they had some lovers quarrel or fight, why would it have been left with their daughter?
It's not about romance, I said with sudden certainty. It's always been about revenge.
I flipped the card over and traced the double infinity symbol. Two paths, two different types of cards, two fates. One infinite, everlasting loop for justice.
And who might the murderer be, then?
I thought of Gian and his short temper. Andreas had mentioned his entire family had been slain. The details of that crime had been impossible to wrench from either of them. Then there was Cassie and Sebastian, and the people they owed money to. Might those people be the Ardens, Crenshaws, and Prescotts? Did they find some means of extorting money from the performers, and they stood to lose everything? Anisha and Andreas also couldn't be taken from the list of suspects. Each of them had reason for vengeance and knew the card's meanings. Though from everything I'd gathered, most every performer had a base knowledge in tarot. Even I had been instructed to learn and practice with both tarot and the playing cards. Harry Houdini didn't strike me as a criminal, but then again, the murderers I'd encountered hadn't either. Then there was the ringmaster, the person who'd created an entire carnival that hid behind new masks each night. The young man who'd taught me everything about sleight of hand and sleight of word, and could not ever be fully trusted to reveal his true hand. I gazed out at the sliver of moon, appearing more like a scythe ready to strike than anything else, unable to stop seeing it as a portent of new horrors to come. Tonight is the last night, I finally said, shifting my attention back to the ringmaster. He was free from a mask right now, but that, much like the sudden stillness of the sea, wouldn't last. A flash of Liza's finger lying in the velvet box crossed my mind. I squeezed my eyes shut, then opened them. Clouds slowly crept across the sky, lining up in formation. A storm would break by morning, but hopefully I'd have my cousin back before then. One more performance. If only there was just one suspect left before the finale. 38. Grand Finale. Captain's Quarters, RMS Etruria, 8 January, 1889. Captain Norwood twisted in his overstuffed leather chair, his gaze stubbornly fixed on the glass half-filled with amber liquid, sitting on his mahogany desk. It was hardly past sunrise, though judging from the whiskers on his face, he hadn't yet been to bed.
Chief Magistrate Prescott hasn't heard from Dr. Arden in days, and mentioned arguing over whether to come forward with certain information they'd received, so I told the chief mate to enter the doctor's chambers.
Norwood sipped from his glass, then winced.
There wasn't any blood, but the room was a mess. I don't think his is a story that's going to end well, especially given that note.
At my raised brow, Uncle walked over to where I stood and handed the crumpled paper to me. I recognized the handwriting as the same from the note I'd received regarding Liza, and my heart picked up its beat. Dear Dr. Arden, I have a riddle I cannot solve. Perhaps your skill with sums will prove better than mine. One wretched lord, one corrupted magistrate, and one cowardly doctor equals one innocent life stolen. Which of the three is most responsible? Every night this goes unanswered, another life will be forfeit. Choose selflessness, and I'll show mercy you do not deserve. Choose selfishness, and you will see my wrath. I swallowed the sudden lump in my throat and discreetly handed the note to Thomas, stomach churning. The postmark was the 1st of January, the very day we'd set sail. If Dr. Arden had only brought this to the captain then, perhaps he might have secured the passengers before anyone had lost her life. I exhaled. If only and what could have been had no place here now. Although, if Prescott and Arden were arguing over this very thing the day after Miss Prescott was murdered, they were likely too frightened to say anything else, lest the murderer make good on his threats, which he did anyway.
It's highly possible, given the threat laid out in that note, that his arm is the one that had been severed.
Uncle walked over to the porthole and inspected the water running down the glass in thick, frantic rivulets. The storm broke just prior to daybreak, and the rest of our journey would not be an easy one.
It was male and had a wedding band. Though without a body, it's all conjecture. He might very well be holed up in another cabin. Have you contacted his wife?
Norwood swirled his drink.
He was a widower.
Thomas and I exchanged glances from our post near the wall, our problems from the night before pushed aside in light of our work. We were to be present, but Uncle had wanted us to remain silent and study the captain. Everyone was suspect at this point. A sharp rap on the door finally drew the captain's gaze upward.
Yes?
A wiry man in uniform stepped in and promptly removed his cap, nodding to us before addressing the captain.
We checked all the performers and their trunks and didn't find anything unusual, Captain. Seems like everything is ready for the show.
Thomas pressed his mouth into a flat line. He needn't say so out loud, but there was no way the crew could be certain what was and what wasn't a murder weapon. The performers had swords and daggers and ropes and handcuffs and countless other oddities that might be used. Uncle looked at me and Thomas, then turned his attention back on the captain, twisting his moustache in the way that set my nerves on edge.
With all due respect, you ought to cancel the finale altogether. There's no way this is going to end well for anyone.
Norwood tossed back the rest of his drink, the rain now pelting the side of the ship. It sounded like hail.
I'm afraid it can't get much worse, Dr. Wadsworth.
A tingle raced down my spine. I knew by now that no amount of arguing would alter the captain's abysmal decisions. I wish I possessed the same sentiments, but knew this finale would be the spectacle the murderer had been waiting for, his epic ending of revenge. Tonight's stage reflected the overall feeling of the ship. The inky curtains were overlaid with tattered grey gauze, giving the appearance of a mouldering tomb. Even the roses, which had been painted black, seemed foreboding and on the brink of decay. Passengers sat so quietly at their tables, they might as well have been corpses in a grave. Food remained mostly untouched, though it appeared to be edible artwork, the way the lobster claws reached toward the heavens, and the fillets were sliced to perfection. I pushed English peas around my plate, unable to eat either. Tonight was the last of our treacherous voyage, and everyone seemed as if they were perched upon needles, waiting for the final celebration, or funeral. It would be another sort of death, in a way, one that determined the fate of the Moonlight Carnival. Mephistopheles was determined to make it memorable, though I could not shake the sense that the murderer had the same sentiments. This was the moment he'd been waiting for, the grandest unveiling of all. He'd carefully plotted his revenge, and I feared nothing would prevent him from seeing it through. I prayed that Liza was all right, that she would not be the star of our show. I felt Thomas's gaze on me, calculating and methodical. He hadn't attempted to continue our talk from last night, and it both relieved and worried me.
Are you all right, Wadsworth?
Of course. I flicked my attention to him, then back to the doors. The plague doctors would be entering any moment now. Shortly after that, I'd be called up to the stage. A lucky volunteer, chosen to brave Andreas's magical looking glass, and then stand against Gian's daggers. It seemed as if my random training sessions would be useful after all.
You're not planning anything scandalous without me, are you?
Thomas asked, voice low enough to avoid Mrs. Harvey hearing. Uncle had excused himself to direct the search for Liza, and it had taken every ounce of self-control I had not to chase after him and forego the finale.
That would be unfair, you know. I'm quite good at improvising, especially after some wine.
He held his glass of white wine up, a crooked smile easing onto his face. The calculation remained in his gaze, however, telling me he wasn't about to believe the next lie that spilled from my mouth, no matter how well its delivery was. Things were still tense between us after our midnight conversation, and would likely remain that way until we could truly talk, though I was not convinced it would go any differently. Perhaps I wasn't the marrying kind. Maybe I'd always seek freedom from any perceived cage, real or imagined, no matter how often Thomas assured me otherwise. He deserved someone who could banish their doubts. Perhaps he and I were only meant to be work partners. I sighed. I'm to participate in the finale. And no, I whispered, as his face partially lit up. You are not permitted to assist me. I didn't interfere when you volunteered to be cut in half. He drew back as if I'd slapped him.
Is this what you've been doing at night with Mephistopheles?
Thomas, I warned. He sounded so hopeful, but a flash of my kiss with the ringmaster reminded me how tired of lies I was becoming. I hadn't initiated it, and it might have only lasted a second, but the kiss still happened. I would not tell him that was all we'd been doing, when it wasn't the entire truth. He swallowed hard and stared down at his plate. Apparently he'd lost his appetite now, too. A string quartet entered the room, their violins and violas playing a soft and dangerous tune. Suddenly, lights fell upon two cellists sitting with their instruments near the edge of the stage, their half-masks glinting in the blue hue that washed over them.
Ah, Brahms's string sextet number 1 in B-flat major.
Thomas closed his eyes, as if soaking in the deliciously played string music.
Opus 18 is one of my favorites, and a fine choice for the finale. It's slow to start, then listen to that there. The melody goes faster, more frantic. The piece builds to a crescendo, and then...
He sat back,
and then it goes back to a sweet warning. Danger is on the horizon.
Yes, well, I began, when the doors burst open, and the truly macabre and bizarre entered the dining saloon. Audible gasps went up around the room, as rows of plague doctors made their silent procession, filing in one after the other, their bird-like white masks even more disturbing against the backdrop of the woeful cellos and violins. Choreographed to perfection, once they'd invaded the space between the tables, they all stopped, pivoted, and began waltzing around, holding their sleek black cloaks out with one arm. They looked like birds with broken wings. Herbal scents wafted around, no doubt from the fragrant bits placed in their masks. Mephistopheles had gone the authentic route, sparing no detail. I hoped it didn't mean we'd need the aroma to cover up the scent of decay. The music took a darker turn, the strings more melancholy and deep in tone, raising goose flesh down my arms. String sextet number 2, Thomas murmured, brows tugged together. Another appropriate choice. Though it seems, Mephistopheles nearly exploded onto the stage. He appeared behind a wall of igniting fireworks, the white sparkling flares shooting high to the ceiling and remaining that way for several beats of my heart. Smoke lingered before him, greyish tendrils curling about before disappearing. The room now stank of sulfur.
Ladies, gentlemen.
He swept his arms out, and instead of simply appearing like wings, his cloak actually had black feathers sewn onto it. So inky and dark, it looked almost iridescent.
Welcome to the grand finale. I promised magic, mischief, and mayhem. And this...
He walked around in a wide circle, lights clicking on and illuminating different acts already set up in rings on the stage.
This evening is devoted to mayhem. Prepare to be swept into the space between dreams and nightmares. Welcome to the final night of the Moonlight Carnival.
Resplendent in her dragon costume, Anisha stepped into a ring on stage. The pearly lavender scales practically glowed as she blew fire out in long bursts. The audience in front screeched, moving their chairs swiftly back and away, hoping to avoid being burnt. Another bright floodlamp clicked on, drawing the crowd's attention skyward, where Cassie shot across the room like a shooting star, tumbling from one trapeze to the next. My heart thrummed. Clowns juggling colorful balls hopped from side to side, making faces. A tattooed woman with a large snake picked her way through the saloon, sashaying as she went, her pet hissing whenever anyone stared too hard. Once everyone was in their spots, it would be my turn. I gripped my napkin beneath the table, focusing on my breath. Finally, Andreas and Gian made their way into the room, hoisting Houdini upside down on a large wooden scaffold as they went. He was wearing a straitjacket, over which his entire body was woven in chains. I hadn't seen him practice this trick, and I imagined it was yet another secret the ringmaster had kept to himself. Once Houdini was strung up like a fish that had been caught, wriggling on the line, Mephistopheles stomped his feet 3 times, and rings of fire went up around each act. This was it. I sunk my teeth into my bottom lip, watching each performer for any hints as to who might be plotting murder this very moment. Everyone seemed suspicious, and nearly each of them had motive. My pulse sped up. Any moment now.
A volunteer is needed from the audience tonight.
Mephistopheles walked from one end of the stage to the other, gloved hand shielding his eyes from both the flames and blaring lights.
Who amongst you is brave enough to stand before the night's blades of fury? Who has the strength to stare into the magical Bavarian looking glass and witness their future?
The room seemed to hold its breath. Not one person moved, lest they were called up to the stage. Understanding dawned brightly. Here was yet another reason Mephistopheles had asked me to participate in the finale. He'd feared this very thing would happen. After the first murder, he'd purchased a bit of insurance for his carnival. The show would go on, and he would have audience participation, even if that was an illusion as well. I slowly stood, my red and black striped evening gown suddenly feeling 2 sizes too small.
Audrey Rose, wait.
Thomas's voice was low and urgent.
Don't. Something is wrong. Where's the contortionist?
I gestured up to the ceiling as Cassie vaulted from one trapeze to the next,
where I knew Sebastian was waiting for his cue to join her in flight.
You!
Mephistopheles jumped from the stage, his cloak wings spread out intimidatingly. Diners at the nearest table quickly shot up from their seats and rushed to the doors, dodging around the plague doctors, who continued to waltz to the same two songs that were being replayed. Apparently the costumes were a bit too frightening, and the sudden movement of the ringmaster wasn't helping to quell their fears.
Come, sweet lady.
He offered his arm.
Let us see what fate has in store for you this evening.
I squeezed Thomas's shoulder lightly and accepted the ringmaster's arm. Once we were on stage, waiting for the target board to be rolled out, the gravity of the night finally struck me. Someone was either about to die, or their corpse was about to be displayed. Of that much I was near certain. Neither of those scenarios would be welcome, especially if my cousin was harmed. Or if the someone was me. I wiped my palms down the front of my bodice. The stage lights were hotter than I'd thought. Or perhaps standing before the crowd, though it was a fraction of what it once had been at the start of the week, was more unnerving than I'd imagined it to be. I subtly glanced from Gian's blades, glinting each time he swung them around, to Anisha spitting fire, to Houdini, already half freed from his constraints. He'd escape these new bonds and make yet another legendary story of himself. Andreas, in full plague doctor costume, stood before his looking glass, as if standing guard over the future. All I needed to do was step up to the target board, and the true finale would start. I hoped it would not be my death march.
Ladies and gentlemen,
Mephistopheles crooned,
let the mayhem begin.
Fireworks burst off in the corners of the saloon like fountains of sparkling water. It might not have been the best idea, considering how jumpy everyone already was. One woman collapsed onto her table, squishing the lobster and sauce across her bosom. Another man shoved back from his seat so quickly he fell over. Plague doctors nearby assisted them, which might have been more frightening than the loud noise. Even amongst the stirring crowd, Thomas drew my attention as he always did. His sharp gaze stuck to something behind me, brows knit. I half turned, but only saw the looking glass. No one was lurking behind it. No bodies hanging, set ablaze or submerged. It was just as it always had been, except it appeared as if the ringmaster had finally convinced Andreas to clean it up a bit.
Miss Wadsworth, Mephistopheles whispered, it's time.
I took a deep breath and picked my way around the rings of fire until I stood before Gian's target board. A woman's silhouette had been painted onto it, allowing the audience a hint as to what was to come. I went to reach for a blindfold, but Gian gave one jerk of his head.
Not tonight. Here.
He handed me an apple, his taunting smile softening into something that almost looked like respect, as I took it without so much as a tremor in my hands.
Place this on your head, and don't move.
I swallowed hard, eyes darting around the saloon in search of a bit of strength, a nod of support. What I needed was my best friend. Except Thomas was nowhere to be seen.
Miss Wadsworth,
Mephistopheles said, briefly taking my hand in his and squeezing it in comfort.
Be brave.
In a haze, I slowly walked to the target board, mind moving faster than the silver-clad stiltwalkers who'd just entered the room, spinning teacups on sticks. For Thomas to have left. I reached the board and brought the blood-red apple to the top of my head, only half thinking about my safety. Liza. He had to have figured something out about my cousin. Or was he too angry to sit and watch me on stage? Perhaps he worried Mephistopheles and I might have been practicing our own act, and the thought made him ill. Gian barked commands at the audience, but all I felt was the heat from the lights, the sound of the crackling flames nearly drowning out the string sextet as it lurched into the next melody, and the general cacophony ringing in both my ears and my chest. A bead of sweat rolled between my shoulder blades. Something was wrong. I stared, unseeingly, at Gian's waistcoat. It was unusual for the Moonlight Carnival. It was made of cloth, stitched with an enchanted forest from a fairy tale, complete with vines and trees and constellations. I'd seen it before. A knife sailed through the air, landing near my ear. Another rapidly followed, sinking deep into the wood on the opposite side. My pulse roared. I'd missed something, something that had caught Thomas's attention. I could have sworn my makeup was melting down my face under the burning lights. Another knife struck near my skull. Thomas had been staring at the looking glass. But Andreas couldn't be the one who'd stolen my cousin and severed her finger. He was right there, doing card tricks with the now free Houdini. Apple pulp sprayed down around me, the juice sticky and sweet as it stuck to my face and neck. The crowd surged to its feet, bringing their hands together. The knight had dazzled them with his blades once more. I couldn't concentrate on the here and now, however. Andreas lifted his plague doctor mask and stole a quick sip of water. Gian took a slow, deliberate bow, eyes fixed to mine. Cassie smiled down from above, her mask glinting like a blade. I swallowed hard, attention straying to Anisha, who swung twin ropes of flames and then spit them perilously close to where I stood. Each of them was beautiful, yet deadly. And perhaps they were all guilty. I stumbled across the stage, thoughts circling clues, like crows circling a carcass, when an arm came down around my shoulders, tugging me near.
"Everything all right, Miss Wadsworth?"
Mephistopheles asked.
"If you don't smile and take a little bow, you're going to frighten the audience."
I went to comply, when recognition finally struck me. The stolen fabric!
"Later," Mephistopheles said. "Please bow and take your seat."
"No," I whispered. "Gian's the murderer. We have to get him off the stage, now."
"What?"
"Gian's the murderer," I nearly shouted. Across the stage, Gian cocked his head, spinning a knife in one hand as someone might do with a pistol.
"What did you just say?"
A row of can-can dancers emerged from behind him, kicking their limbs high, their skirts in shades of vermilion, chartreuse, and cobalt. They were the only splashes of color in a moonlight palette, and they were currently making Gian's progression toward me quite difficult. He wove through the line of dancers, ducking back from their kicks, gaze hard as he towered over me.
"You've got no proof for that accusation, do you?"
Gian demanded. Mephistopheles somehow managed to tug us behind the dancers and their voluminous skirts, almost as if he'd also predicted this and wanted the scene to be blocked from the audience's view.
"The fabric you're wearing, that was stolen days ago," I said, nodding to his waistcoat. "We believe the murderer is to blame, and here you are, wearing it for the whole audience. Tonight is your big finale, isn't it?"
Gian stared down at his waistcoat, blinking as if he'd only just noticed it.
"This was a gift."
"A gift from whom?" I asked, unconvinced, although the hurt flashing in his eyes was hard to miss.
He glanced at Mephistopheles while the dancers retreated behind the curtain.
"From?" "Ladies and gentlemen," an accented voice boomed through the dining saloon. "Please direct your attention to our grandest performance yet. May I present the Hanged Man?"
Mephistopheles, Gian, and I stared at one another, expressions matching masks of dread, as all the lights in the room went out at once.
39. Spectacular Spectacle. Dining Saloon, RMS Etruria, 8 January, 1889. A floodlight flashed on near the end of the stage, illuminating a shadowy corner in a ghostly white-blue. Next to the unmistakable old looking glass, Dr. Arden swung slowly from a noose. His eyes bulged, and a black tongue protruded from his gaping lips. His left arm was missing at the elbow. All sounds in the room ceased. Even the mournful violins screeched to a halt at the sight. My attention, however, snagged on something worse, and my blood chilled at the impossibility before me. Thomas sat facing the magic looking glass, blindfolded, a garrote around his neck. His hands were bound behind his back. The fortune teller must have lured him on stage, a feat that wouldn't have been hard, considering how much Thomas had wanted to join me for the finale.
"If anyone moves,"
Andreas said quietly, his voice projected from some mechanical device.
this young man dies.
Mephistopheles shifted beside me, but held his hand up, stalling the performers from making any sudden